So welcome, everyone. Welcome. A delight to see you all. We're going to continue the theme that we have been promoting this year, and that is the continuum of practice, the continua of practice that we've been talking about, in different ways to look at how the practice unfolds. And from a different vantage point, from a different perspective, and to just to check ourselves, to make sure that we're moving in a wise direction all along the way. Because there are so many very subtle traps and ways that we can get caught in little eddies and just spin around and actually think we're moving forward when actually we're being pulled backward through our own unwise strategies. And so it's just to flush out all of those different points, and hopefully you'll find something within each talk that allows you to move forward with a little more confidence and a little more wisdom. So to that point, I'd just like to say that, you know, in the troubled times that this world seems to be in, with the multiple conflicts and wars and difficulties, the climate and the terrorism, that wise action, many of us think in terms of protesting some of the ways that we can to try to move the momentum in the direction of wisdom, is fundamental to what we need to be doing in life, but more fundamental than that, and really the point of meeting here every Tuesday, is that we change ourselves in accordance to the truth. Once the truth is ingrained within us so that we perceive from the truth, we don't keep referencing the truth to decide how to act. That's a different level of integration of Dharma. But to perceive the truth, and so that our actions come from that perception. That's what we're doing here. And that will make all the difference. Our protests, although worthy and noble, have since time immemorial not changed the direction of the conflict here on earth. In 200,000 years of the human being, this is the way it's looked like. It's just different formations of the same violence, the same retaliation, the same vengeance. And although very important for each of us to stand up and to make a physical and vocal statement about the way that we would like to see life move, still without that basic fundamental change in our being, it will be temporary at best. So just to know that when we're sitting here, we're not doing something that's extraneous to everything that's going on. We're doing something fundamentally important about what's going on. And that you're not wasting your time here, where you should be out protesting or doing whatever you think is a more called and fruitful action. So tonight I'd like to look at something that is a very important continuum to myself, because when I was young, and I probably have said this story many times, but at 68 I have an excuse for repetition. But when I was young, perhaps in my first 10 years, I felt somehow very contained within my consciousness, that I couldn't get out of it. That all the arrows kept pointing like this, and I kept having the same responses, and I was held within a kind it was almost chambered inside a chambered life, and it felt a lack of freedom, because I just couldn't get outside the mind. It just froze and directed everything I did. So there weren't very many people at that time that gave me much encouragement about what to do. And in fact, they looked at me very quizzically and thought I was a little strange. So I gave up that questioning But that sense of containment continued on. I just didn't pay it as much attention as I did early on until I found the Dharma. And I thought, oh, so this, there's something going on here. Tonight I'd like to talk about the ascension, the ascent of practice and the descent of practice. And what we're ascending, the ascension out of, is this sense of self-containment of this predominantly ego-centered world that we live in. And the life that we undertake and all the arrows sort of moving in the direction of our own self-serving purposes and intentions. And yet there are 7 billion of us on the planet, and somehow we don't have room in our hearts for anything except our own desire and selfishness. And that bothered me early on, because I could see myself entrapped within that greed response. And so when we get involved in the Dharma, over time, there is a period in which we feel like we're ascending out of that. That suddenly we arise out of that self-centered approach. And now I don't mean that it's one night we're saying everything I, me, and mine, the next day it's all we and they. It's not like that at all, as you are very well aware. It's a transitional period of time, lasting a long period of time, in which this sort of cloistered existence within ourselves begins to have some breath, air, and wind move through it. And so we actually begin to sense ourselves as becoming less compacted. And that's a tremendous sense of freedom, of lightness. We also, accompanying that, is a sense that there's something we can trust in the world. And many of us have spent our years betraying ourselves and others, and having others betray us as well. And there's a sense of mistrust that we have grown up with. And here, all of a sudden, we find an objective view of life. We find something that's worthy of our trust. If we look at it and see it, we know it's there. We know that that's true. And we can make the decision not to look, but then we know we're not looking, and we have to face that consequence as well. But it's something that is very clear to us when we are present and aware and seeing something. We can see it, we can understand it, and it's trustworthy. And we don't rely on others to have to tell us anything different than what our eyes reveal. So accompanying this sense of being less compacted is this sense of expanded trust. And along with that comes an assurance, as I've spoken about before, of knowing I am here. Instead of having thought our way out of here into a different location, into a different time, never feeling that we deserve to be in the time and place that we are in, we don't reference ourselves as being, of having a firm place on the earth. And suddenly we do. And I am here, and I am now. And those two words, although used too repetitively in Dharma, have a focal point for us. I'm here. I'm here, and it's now. And they start bearing fruit as we encourage their development. And this, again, is the ascension of the practice, where we're moving outside of the confusing, compacted, dense relationship of an egoic, driven life. And we're beginning to breathe. You know, the air, it's very much like a climb up a mountain. In fact, that analogy is very appropriate. We're ascending the mountain. And for those of you who are hikers or who have ascended a mountain before, you know that you know, as you move up, each turn in the mountain path quite often holds a vista, a view that is startling, often in its beauty, in its perspective of where you've been and what you've climbed. And this new perspective really alters your inward life, right? You have been on hikes where the beauty of what you see, the rapture, is, it alters it. It's like, whoa, you know, you just can't pass it by. It's just another scene. And so too in Dharma, as we unpack the density of our egoic formation, as we find our place on the earth of here and now, as we begin to trust and have confidence in what we see so that no one can take that away from us. It's not like an A paper can be downgraded to a C. This is a seeing, A plus seeing. This is seeing for its own sake, but privileged because it cannot be taken away. And that allows a spirit in us, a spirit of both adventure, to keep climbing, to keep looking at these new vista points, to keep having insights as we move around and ascend up out of our condensed and dense life. And we keep coming to greater advantages and seeing from more clarity. And this, it's truly a joyful time in practice. I can remember in Thailand having this particular time in practice where everywhere I turned there was insight. It was like it was a continuous ascent of the mountain. And I first tried to write everything down because I was afraid I would never remember them. But then I thought, this is crazy. There's no reason to write it down because there's no end to the flooding of insight. Insight doesn't have a certain number and then it doesn't come. It just is forever. And that beautiful of heartfelt freedom of asking sincere questions and having the discovery right in front of you, not relying on books or texts or teachers or anyone, but having that sense of freedom and that sense of sort of uncloistered living, even though I was a monk. And there's a beautiful sense of climbing out of our old sense of self. Now, in fact, as we move along this continuum from the ascent to the descent, and I'll talk about the descent in just a minute, but the ascent is it suddenly who you've been, you're kind of ascending outside of your egoic sense of self. It doesn't, the way you've looked at yourself prior to this, you can't fit yourself back into the same box. Your thoughts are seen differently. They your life is on a trajectory that is mysterious to you. Emotions don't have the same complicating effect upon us. We can live with our minds with a certain degree of confidence rather than fear. And the packaging, all of this packaging, including the narrative that has accompanied our life, has a clearer focus and a clearer direction forward. We really feel that the space of that ascent. And we are learning unmistakably in our ascent how to love. And that sense of love is not egoically controlled. For some reason, as we ascend beyond just the personal representation of love, but to a more inclusive expression of love. And this happens, I don't know how. None of us have an understanding. We adjust in the course and the discipline that's necessary in the early part of practice and the rigor of willing to look, to see, to face what is there and not to deny what is there. The ascent happens. It happens on its own. And there's a wonderful quality of uplift in the heart. It truly feels buoyant at times. Feels buoyant. And the sense of being on top of ourselves, you know, sort of like the way we were when we were young, when somebody said something that negated us or created some internal pain, so it evoked our pain body. Those same people, they're not hated or disliked, they just don't have the same effect anymore on us. And if they say things, it's like we can see that it's their perspective, and that their perspective may have an intentionality and a manipulative part to it. And we can see all that as well, because the clearer we see ourselves, the clearer we see others. And so the world doesn't foster the same kind of intrusion that it used to, or the combative nature of it. And it doesn't matter what tradition we're in. What matters is our willingness to look and our willingness to see, and the clarity from which we see. And this beautiful ascent of the meditation is, I would say, well over half the practice. Well over half. And the sense of love, being able to actually have space so that I can feel differently about myself. We see that the limitations that we have imposed upon ourselves and the way that we have been stuck within ourselves and our own pain, it has a way forward. We have a way forward through all of that. We don't have to. It's not like a car stuck in mud where the wheels just turn anymore. There's a way out of this. There's a way forward. And this sense of love begins to naturally fall upon us. We actually care about ourselves in a way that we have never done so. And so it's almost like we're coming out of ourselves, which we really are. We're ascending out of ourselves, out of our egoic self. And what we then see, the vantage point, the perspective, the vistas, is that we begin to have a deep caring for humanity. For humanity. Not pretentious. Not like I should care about others, but I don't really, but I'll pretend like I do, or I'll make the actions in accordance with that, but I don't really believe it. No, a true caring. A true caring. Where the tragedies of France, you feel that, you feel that. Can't bypass something like that. You can't go back and pretend like it didn't happen. You don't turn away from it. And again, that's the ascension. That's the ascension. That's the Easter of our life. Learning to love. But the ascension is still brain focused. And the ascension still moves with strategies. You know, I want to get my practice right, I need to do this, and so there's a lot of seeking in the ascension. There's a lot of expanding. I need new teachers, that one's whatever. New perspectives, new views, new insights, new goals. Oh, we're working this thing from a mental brain perspective. We're looking for new ways to move ourselves forward, but it's new strategies to get over the parts of ourselves that we still having trouble with. All of that, you know, it's still a complicated practice. It's a very complicated practice. The ascension has a lot of beauty to it, has a lot of joy. But it's very complicated. We make it very hard. And, you know, we're trying to follow it like we were, like it was some sort of an intense study of nuclear physics or something, where it's like, okay, what does this mean? What? Trying to get it all right and managed and directed in the proper form. And there's a lot of a sense of, you know, am I doing it okay? A lot of, even though we're growing out of the egoic-centered nature, it still has its hold on us sufficiently. So, you know, how am I doing? God, it's been so many years and still I do this. And where am I on this path? You know, I want to know where on the mountain I am here. You know, so don't fool around. Just tell me, am I a failure? You know, because behind us is that fear that we are just that. And in this sense, and this is an important point, there's no end to the ascent. Right? There's always more to do. Right? When we quantify anything in our minds, which is how the brain works on life, it quantifies it, there's no end in it. I mean, I'm this far, but could I go further? I've got this much samadhi, but if I did this, I would have more samadhi. And then, well, I have that, and I did that, and now I have that samadhi, but I could have more. And it dawns on us that at some point we sober to that, because all along our meditation and our awareness has grown, and we are perceiving our motives, not just our breath. We're also perceiving what drives us forward. And we're beginning to sense that this repetitious need to improve upon where I am is a kind of nagging struggle that we carry along with our ascension. Yeah, you know that one? And yet, we don't really know what else we can do. We're experiencing the ease and naturalness of ourselves. We can walk now, even in the noise of the urban life, and there can be a kind of contentment from time to time that we feel, or a spaciousness, kind of a delight. We can feel joyful and in the most unusual circumstances. But still there's this sense that I have more to do. I'm not there yet. And at that point, this is a kind of a hard point, because all of that was very important. The ascension spiritually strengthened our muscle and ripened us, you might say, for the next insight. And the next insight is that there is one task that remains. You're right? Up until this point, although I have been growing outside of myself egoically, still, I'm the center of my attention. I really haven't questioned myself beyond the egoic difficulty I've been having with myself. I'm still self-contained. And yes, there's moments of feeling spacious and feeling connected with humanity, of feeling light and joyous about myself. But as a brain-centered activity, it doesn't let us escape completely. And we feel, you know, as we are moving up the mountain, we also feel the force of gravity on that climb. And the force of gravity in this sense is that self-centeredness that we're carrying with us. It burdens our pack. And at some point, and this is a very tentative point, because some people never reach it, because the ascension is too wonderful, and there's more to do. So why question the rub? You see, we know it's there, but we think, well, that's just the way it is. You know, in school, I always could do better. No matter where I was in the class, there was somebody ahead of me, and I could always promote and go forward a little bit. And why should Dharma be any different? Even though it claims to resolve the issue of struggle, still, this may be a struggle that is just intrinsic to being alive and just keep going upward. And there are many practices that focus on a never-ending ascent up the mountain. And again, as we ascend, even though we realize there's a struggle involved, still there's a further beautification of our minds that is taking place. And we hear the words of the path of purity, Vasudhi Magga, and we think, oh, so, you know, I can feel myself becoming more pure. And that has a tremendous hold on us, because behind us, behind our minds, pushing us, has always been this sense of connecting the spiritual journey with some sense of purity, some sense of self-perfection. And so when we feel that sense of self-improvement, we intuit that we are moving in a wise direction, because it is fulfilling our own need toward purity. And along with that, we become more integritous. As we move outside of our self-centeredness and share space with humanity, our heart follows suit. And so there's a natural willingness to abide in action in accordance with that principle of others being as important as myself. Not being more important than myself, being as important as myself. And so now we come to a very tentative time in our practice, one that, again, many of us will not concede. And that is to realize that this ascension is a forever process. That the mountain has false summits. I come to a certain summit, I think, oh, I'm there, and I look up, and oh my God, just over the ridge is another summit, and I have to walk up there, and then there's another summit. And pretty soon it's not the small mountain we are looking at, but Rainier and beyond. And so at some, it just, you have to start questioning whether the summation of the journey is going to be ascending, coming out of ourself. See, it's a very honest question. And it was, I'm not sure this is where I wanted the ascension to go. I love the ascension. It was wonderful. I appreciated it. But I don't know if I want to make this turn now, you see. I don't know if I want to say, and descend after what's down there for me, right? And again, the joke that I think is appropriate at this time is that the man who is rappelling down a steep cliff and has a shortened rope, so that he only gets halfway down the cliff and he still has a 150 feet drop to his sure death with jagged peaks below him, and he doesn't have enough energy to climb back up the rope, so he does what most of us would do, is we yell out to God, is there anyone up there who can help me? But in this particular story, God answers and says, yes, I can help you. But first, you have to let go of the rope. And the man looks down at the sure death of letting go of the rope, and he looks back up and he says, is there anyone else up there who can help me? And that's a little bit like this moment in which our ascension begins to turn. Because when it's turning and we're looking down and we're thinking, you know, what am I doing this for? I wanted to build upon what I was, which is really what we've been doing. We've been building outside of the egoic frame of reference, but nevertheless building on our sense of performance, upon our sense of perspective, upon our everything, upon our love of life, everything. And if we turn back down and descend, what are we? We're descending outside of that performance issue. We're having to let go, you see, instead of encouraging and promoting and accumulating, we are asked to release. So we ascend to the joy of being someone, but we descend to no one special. We ascend to gain ground, right? But we descend to surrender the ground we just gained. And it's you can feel it, can't you? That it's like, wait a minute. You see, it's kind of a deflation there. So I go, okay, why should I be doing this now? Like, I have to give myself a Dharma rap here. What's going on? What is this about? Why would I want to become nothing when I'm at the peak of my creation? And this is the false nirvana and the counter influence at this point. The false nirvana is that for our whole life, we've wanted some acclaim, something that shows us that we weren't the dense packaging that we thought we were. And yet at the same time, we'd like to carry that to our death with us. And yet we realize unless we let that go, we will be on a forever path of struggle. And the Buddha's direction of from struggle to the end of struggle comes to mind. And we realize that if we did that, we would be wandering off the path entirely. Up until this point, we haven't wandered off the path at all. It's not to think that we've been doing something wrong up until now. This is for almost all of us, and perhaps all of us, this is the way we move to the point in which we make that turn. Most of us can't do that without the ascension. If we do it prematurely and would like to, we hear somebody talking about releasing themselves, sounds great, maybe I can get ahead of the game and do it now before we have felt the full glory of ourselves, likely it won't work. We have to come to an internal impasse in ourselves where we simply realize that we have nowhere else to go but down. And at that point, then we acquiesce to that. And so the false nirvana has shown us that we have to leave our fantasy behind. You see, we're dismembering our fantasy because we're still building ourselves conceptually in, it's hard to say incongruent to the world or to reality, but because it has been congruent up until that point. It's fit our understanding. It's taken us outside of our entrapped view, our limitation, shown us the space of love, of generosity, of patience. It's given us a new life, and a life that feels deeply meaningful. And so the ascent is full of meaning and purpose. We know where we're going, why we're doing it, and those poor people who just didn't get involved in meditation, I don't know what to say about them. And so we turn. Now let me just give you an example of how that turning affects something like emotions. Because up until this point, the highs and lows have been kind of precious to us. I mean, when we're egoically involved, we barely recognized that we had feelings. That if you're male, you probably didn't recognize you had feelings, and you were controlled by the feelings no matter whether you felt them or not. And so we're coming out of that sense of being imprisoned to our emotions. And that the ascent was also ascending outside of the entrapped way that our feelings controlled us. Now, on the descent, we realize that feelings are a component part of life, but we don't hook the value of life up to a feeling, to an emotion. We don't have to have a high in order to be validated or to validate our actions. And lows don't somehow show us, you know, where we need to sort of kick ourselves into gear and get going. We're not dependent upon the narrative of our emotions for moving through sanity. In fact, sanity is now much more evenly felt than being determined by emotion. And so we don't add, when emotions do arise, which up until then we did add, a whole expression of narrative to the emotions as they were emerging. You're doing well, I can feel it, you know. Emotions, at the basis, determined our ascent. When we were feeling joyful, you know, we really encouraged those feelings forward because they meant that we were going in a wise direction, et cetera, et cetera. Now emotions don't steer the vehicle. They don't steer us. They have their place. They're part of the internal expression of humanity. But they are no longer given the validity we were prior to this. Now that happens as effortlessly as all the other components of the ascent or the descent. This is not something that you think, okay, now I have to have a different relationship to my emotions. This is not a conscious, willful act. This happens from wisdom. This happens by having seen repetitively what emotions do and how they steer the path often disastrously forward. And you go, wait a second here, what's going on? Now this descent it sounds like we're losing something. And to the person, who has just built him or herself up on the ascent, that we are losing something. We're losing our stake in it. We're losing our position in it, in life. We're losing the repetition of the I in relationship to all external experiences. But what else other choice do we have? And so we don't yet have any accompanying sense of fulfillment that the descent will ultimately give us. But we can't keep ascending. We just know that. And so we turn. And we ascend, when we descend back into ourselves. This is what's so interesting, really. We come right back, body, mind. The ascent was in some ways to try to leave ourselves. We were trying to ascend outside of all of this content and all. But when we descend back into the very fabric of body and mind. But we do it from a very different perspective. Because the problem was never with the content. It was the perception of the content, from where the content we thought was coming, and what it meant. And now we've been reoriented. All the ascent led to a deepening of wisdom and reorientation. And so we can come down the mountain and come back into ourselves. And we descend back into the world. And we descend back into the totality of the world. And the story is the story of Manjushri, the disciple of discriminating wisdom. And he was going up the mountain he was ascending the mountain in order to come to terms with himself and be enlightened. And on the way up, there was a man who was descending, an old man. And he had a hobo's bag on his back with a stick. And Manjushri senses the man knows something that could be helpful to him. And he asks the man, he says, "Old man, what do you know of enlightenment?" And the old man hears and lets go of the stick and drops the burden, drops the bag. And at that moment that the bag dropped, it said that Manjushri awakened, as these stories go. And then the old man said, "Well, I'm not finished." He picks the bag back up and goes down the mountain to the city. Completes the circle. Inso in Japanese. The inso, the circle. You see? There's an ascent and then a descent. And you can see how enticing the ascent was, because how many people are willing to come back into the labor of their humanity and fully own this, and fully own relational positions, instead of claiming the spacious, light, thin air of the mountaintop. And it's to those few who do descend that I bow, and to all of you. So if we could just sit for a minute. And as we sit, I just want to mention that both the ascent and the descent are equally as important. I am not putting weight on one as opposed to the other. And I would caution you to try to move into one prior to your readiness. In fact, don't do that. It's like playing with a loaded gun. You'll shoot yourself in the knee and wound yourself from either ascending or descending. And let me say that the hallmark of descent is the willingness, not the willingness, but the yearning for simplicity, away from the complexity of the brain that drove the ascent. And the desire for quietude. And the need not to be so self-involved, not to be the center of everyone's attention all the time. And yet the willingness to see and release, to see and release, to see and surrender. That's what's required on the descent. On the ascent, it was very complex practicing and intricate. The whole practice was like a maze we were trying to figure out. But on the descent, it's just very simple. Okay, all. Thank you.